Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are, and live with all your faults. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so why don't you smile?
It is 10 minutes after 9 o'clock here on the West Coast of the United States. Joining me is a battle buddy from Afghanistan. John Gerlach joins me. So, John, first of all, good morning. How are you?
Hey, Mac, good morning. I'm just fine. Thanks so much for having me on your program. It's a real honor.
Well, I don't know about that, but thanks for coming on. What the hell? The first of all, John, before we can, like everybody who comes on, we're Marines, so we're naturally skeptical. We have to learn about you so we can figure out if we should believe anything you say or not. So let's talk about you first. You were born and raised where?
I was born in St. John's, Newfoundland, Canada. My dad was U.S. Air Force flight surgeon stationed up in Newfoundland during the Korean War. So I was born out of the country, but raised, you know, around various places because dad was in the service. Call Miami, Florida home because I spent the most time there before I joined the Marines.
What so when you're born outside the country like that, are you a citizen of both countries or just an American citizen that was born on a base overseas?
The former, you get to choose your citizenship, up until the age of 18 and then it automatically defaults to where you're living. So for me, it was a no brainer. I was a U.S. citizen just born on a, an Air Force base.
Got
and
it.
Chose a U.S. citizenship, obviously.
All right. So, how does, after high school, talk about your path to the State Department?
Yeah, and just a minor correction. I was a DOD civil servant when I came to Afghanistan, but State Department was short on folks for both Iraq and Afghanistan. So for two separate tours, a year in Iraq and Ramadi and a year in Afghanistan with you guys in Helmand, I was seconded to State from the Pentagon.
Oh.
Yeah, the road to get there was just, you know, high school, college, PLC program. I went through PLC in 1973 and came in. It was commissioned in 76 and then got out in 88 and went to graduate school and then joined the Defense Department as a in OSD policy, which is the Secretary of Defense's staff. As a foreign policy guy.
So not too many people were joining. I don't know if you know this, John. Not too many people were joining the Marine Corps when you were joining it. Are you aware?
Yeah,
are you
right.
Aware of that?
Yeah, sure. I sure am. Yeah, we had a lot of guys that saw us out on Liberty Call or, you know, in our uniforms, and they were, you know, the general sense of the population at that time was very anti-military. So I'll leave it at that. But it was painful at times.
Hey, let me ask you a question. I watched for the second time the Ken Burns documentary about Vietnam, and the reactions from veterans are. I won't say that mixed. A lot of, especially Vietnam-era veterans, didn't like the way, didn't think that they portrayed the war accurately, that most veterans were extremely proud of their service, and yet all the veterans that you seem to see in the documentary changed in terms of their opposition to the war ultimately. I'm curious, did you watch that?
No, Mac, I haven't seen it yet. I got family members that have seen it. I kind of felt that it was going to be a pretty good chance that that's the way that veterans were going to be portrayed. And so I guess I just kind of have avoided watching it, but I'll have to watch it sometime. And
well,
I think it would be a
I'd be curious because and it will be, but the side of it you'll see that I'd never seen before was and I joined the Marine Corps in 1983, so about 10 years after you did, but grew up in everybody that you know I had as a leader had served in Vietnam. I mean, Vietnam was part of the environment. You heard their tactical lessons, you know, and all of that. But you get to see the perspective of the Viet Cong from them, guys who fought with the Viet Cong talk, and also from the North Vietnamese Army. You get to see their perspective, which I'd never seen in my life before. So I thought that was interesting. The other thing, though, in watching it a second time, I think what Ken Burns tries to do is show you how complex the issue of Vietnam is, militarily, culturally, politically, and historically. And because just about all the major characters, you see them go through this metamorphosis in their life as they follow them through these events. Some, you know, started as fighters and then ultimately wound up protesting war and ultimately came back to something else. So I think – this is just my thought, though. What he tries to show is what a difficult event Vietnam was for us in so many different ways. And I believe that's what he tries to show in following these. So ultimately, when you get done watching it, let me know and I'll bring you back on and we can talk about it.
I will. Thank you. I have been told that he does show quite a bit about the efforts Ho Chi Minh went through to reach out to the U.S. you know, and to get the French to leave them as colonizers and that kind of thing. So yeah, I look forward to seeing it. I guess it's the protest piece of it. That, you know,
well, I would tell you.
Played times.
I would tell you that that's. They were really not very happy because they didn't feel like it was a big enough piece in – I read about their thoughts about it. They didn't feel like it was paid enough attention to in the documentary, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. And so even the story of guys throwing medals on the steps of the Capitol the day that happened, which I think most of us find very offensive, it was interesting to hear that. And I don't know how I missed this in the first one, but I did, that they didn't go down there to throw their medals that day. They were going to make speeches and say, as veterans, we oppose this war, and you have to start telling the truth consistently. And then so what they were going to do was put their medals in a body bag and take the body bag and put it on the steps of the Capitol. Well, I guess a couple of days before the protest was scheduled to happen, there was a fence constructed so they couldn't get near the steps of the Capitol and do what they were wanted to. And the guy who you hear talking, former Marine Lance Corporal who fought at Contien, and we all know, and if you know anything about Contien, it was on up there between the North Vietnamese Army and the Marines. And he said, and that pissed us off, that here we had fought for our country. We came to the steps of our nation's capital to speak, and then they weren't going to allow us to do that. They wouldn't let us get near the Capitol. And this is back in the day when the Capitol was open. And he said, and that's how that happened. That was not our intention to go there that day, but we were pissed. And so I mean, it's just interesting. Events that you've seen and think you know, I mean, when you hear them talk about it, look a little mm-hmm. bit different. So anyway, I don't mean to be sidetracked by that. So what was your MOS in the Marine Corps?
I was a 1802, a tank officer.
Whoa. Nice. So you're a tank officer.
Yeah.
You get out of the Marine Corps. And first of all, so tell me, where were you stationed in the Marine Corps?
Well, you know, of course, Quantico for PLCs and in basic school, and then Camp Pendleton for a tank platoon, and then a tank XO, and then a logistics officer, then on the base staff for a year, and then out to Okinawa, had a tank company there from 81 to 82, and took that for 4 months to for cold weather training. It was really great training, lots and lots of firing, which you can't do really on Okinawa. So had a lot of tank gunnery training. Came back from that and spent 3 years at Parris Island. I had a recruit training company there and worked in the depot ops shop as well. And then went to Central Command for about 4 years. And that's really where I decided I wanted to get out and either go into the Defense Department or State Department, get a graduate degree, you know, get some advanced education. So I got to spend quite a bit of time in the Middle East. I was in Bahrain when the USS Stark was hit by Iraqi cruise missiles, and got to see kind of how the national leadership spins up, you know, to handle something like that, and state and aid, and well, state and DOD, and you know, just about everybody else spun up. It was, you know, sitting on the on the shoulders of the big guys, watching over their shoulder how it worked. It was really amazing. So, and then got out and went to graduate school there in Tampa, Florida, where CENTCOM is, and then came on up to and got work at the Pentagon, and just was there really for the rest of my career, except for my overseas tours.
So what did you see particularly that motivated you that you wanted to be a part of? I mean, for the love of God, how could you get out of the Marine Corps? What the hell is that about? What did you see that you wanted to be a part of?
Yeah, I guess I had not been a very good student in college, and just kind of, you know, kicked around at the C's and B's level.
John, there's nothing wrong with that, okay? Just as somebody who did the same thing, there's nothing wrong, right, with not being a dork in college when you're an undergrad, okay? There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, well, that news is about 30 years too late, but I appreciate it. You know, and then I was at CENTCOM, and I was pretty junior in that headquarters, and really got to see strategic level planning and thinking by guys that were lieutenant colonels and colonels working for 2-3-4-star generals, well, 4-star being the commander. And it really inspired me, and it opened doors to things I had not seen before. You know, it was still the Cold War, so, you know, nuclear posture reviews, you know, the threat of nuclear proliferation, really, really strategic level stuff. And, you know, when you're a captain in the Marine Corps, you're important, and you're working your ass off, and it's good work and it's meaningful. But you very rarely, I think, get a shot at spending time in a headquarters like that, seeing things at that level, or at least at that time, it was kind of unusual. And I just said, you know, there's just a bigger world out there. And there was a graduate course up at University of South Florida, and I took it. It was on Middle East studies, and I really, really was inspired by my my professor. And so I just went for a graduate degree, and about maybe a year into that is when I decided I wanted to go to work for State Department or at a very high level at the Pentagon. And you know, honestly, Mac, I mean, tank officers in the Marine Corps, they're getting rid of tanks now, but there were three battalions and a reserve battalion at the time. So your command opportunities at the lieutenant colonel level were going to be pretty, pretty limited. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it, but I kind of experienced maybe the best times that you can as a tank officer in the Marine Corps, which is, you know, lieutenant and captain commands. And then after that, it was going to be staff stuff. So, yeah, that was what worked for me.
All right. So, tell us about how does your career take you ultimately to Iraq? I know you said you cross-decked from defense to state, but what is your career path until you know 2003, 2004 when you do that?
Right. Well, you know, I was as a tanker, I had a fair amount of logistics experience because those things are pretty logistics intense. And so when I came to D.C., I kind of put a resume together that spoke to logistics experience and Middle East experience, which is, you know, to, at that time was kind of disconnected, not really related things. And I got picked up on a great big foreign military sales program. You know, FMS, Foreign Military Sales, is where the Defense Department sells military articles and services to foreign countries. It's the item manager that does the sale. So if it's an F-18, it's the Navy, you know, that sells it to whoever. And I got to work on the Kuwait purchase of the F-18 from the U.S. Navy. And so I started out as a contractor doing that. And then I ended up as a civil servant working on foreign military sales. In fact, I got to go back to join the Marine Corps as a civil servant after the Gulf War was over. And help the Saudis stand up their Marine Corps. They saw our Marine Corps in action in the deserts, Desert Storm, and they said, you know, holy shit, you know, we want one of those. And, you know, they can write checks for that kind of stuff. And so they put a huge military, a foreign military sales case together and bought really two mechanized brigades worth of equipment. One for the east and one for the west coast of Saudi. And there was a Marine Technical Assistance Field Taft headed up by a Marine colonel who we all kind of worked for. And so I did that for 3 years and then Army staff for about 3 years. You know, it was a move up for me. The Marine Corps staff's foreign military programs are pretty small. The armies are huge. You know, they're selling Apache helicopters to England and, right. You know, Abrams tanks and stuff like that. So I got to work on those programs. And then ultimately, the kind of the top of the foreign military sales pyramid is the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, which is a field activity under a field agency under the Office of the Secretary of Defense. So I got to work there for 4 years and I got to work on Plan Colombia, Mac, which was almost a soft power effort on our part, as opposed to putting troops in country in Colombia. We worked through state and aid and had civil society programs. And then the Defense Department, my piece of it, was providing the Colombian military and the Colombian Special Forces with equipment so they could fight the narco-terrorists. And so the three organizations, state aid and DOD, worked very closely together under Ambassador Jim Dobbins, who was the National Security Council guy that ran this kind of this program. And that was the first time that I ever saw, frankly, it's been about the last time I've ever seen DOD, state and aid work really well together. And the reason is simple. It was leadership. It was Ambassador Dobbins, who was a no bullshit guy, you know, get up on your desk and, you know, rip your head off, you know, like a Marine would do if you screwed up or gave him a limp dick answer. Barry McCaffrey was involved, as you know, General McCaffrey, no nonsense guy. So those three agencies, those three organizations, state aid and DOD, really worked well together and were really tightly synchronized. I didn't see that in Iraq or Afghanistan, but different story. But, you know, just that was a data point for me.
So you're doing that and the wars break out. And what do you see in terms of the opportunity that there will be to go back to or have some role in Iraq? There's a lot of Marines that, you know, that you know that wanted to somehow or other contribute, and you know you'd run into them all the time doing different things. So what did you go to state to help facilitate?
Yeah, we, you know, it was across the river when the plane hit the Pentagon, and we all, you know, realized that it was a sea state change for the world, and right. All the civilians that had been in the military all tried to, you know, get back in the military, myself included. And there were guys, you know, that were picked up. They were in active reserve or whatever. They said, you know, thanks, Gramps. You know, we'll call you if we need you, but we're not desperate yet. So I at that point had left ESCA and I was working in the Pentagon. I wasn't in it when it was hit, but I was working in the Pentagon for the Assistant Secretary of Defense for National Security. And that was a group that, among other country portfolios, had Afghanistan, South Central Asia, and Central Asia, which included the five stands. And I was the Central Asia country director. So we were negotiating after the war started to get base rights at Gansi and K2 and the Gas and Go in Dushanbe and other places. And so that kind of got my feet in the water with the war. It was a year after that, or a year and a half after that, I guess, that we went to war in Iraq. And so I moved around a bit and finally became the director of counterterrorism policy. And for 28 months, kind of watched very carefully the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places too. You know, we were fighting, you know, in Africa and in the Philippines, where Islamic terrorism was springing up all over the place. And after that 28 months, I just decided I was going to volunteer for one of the civilian billets that was being advertised there at the Pentagon. They were asking for volunteers at that point because the state guys had come and gone and the aid guys had come and gone. And, you know, they're usually only good for one or two tours. And then, you know, their monitors move them just like the Marine Corps, you know, to a different geographic location. So they were all, that workforce was all spent. And so volunteered in for Afghanistan, and they assigned me to Iraq. It was where it was needed. And I went and joined the Provincial Reconstruction Team in Ramadi in April 2007, and spent a year there as the chief of governance, working to help the Ramadi government, you know, the Anbar provincial government, stand up and get exercised again. Got to work with General Allen again. I'd seen him at OSD policy. He had been assigned to OSD for a while, and he was on the mess staff when I got there, and was just wonderful. And I've seen you've interviewed him, Mac. He's just really a sterling guy.
Yeah, he was he was the group chief at IOC when I was an instructor there. So that's how I met him. And I do a fairly decent John Allen impersonation. And so no, he's a great guy, and I got warned, Mac, you're not like him. He's not. You're not. You better be careful around him. And he was absolutely incredible to me. He opened up doors and threw me through them and said, "Go get him." And it was awesome. General Allen is he gets it. I mean, he thinks it. You know, he gets it. So interesting. What was Ramadi like in 2007? I mean, it was it had been. I mean, I was there in 2000. I was in Fallujah in 2006, and I used to work at night and do stuff with the special people, and I remember walking into work at like 4:30 one afternoon, and you know it's 125 degrees, but it's a dry 125. Which, you know, that's not bullshit either. Ask anybody who's been to Kuwait, where it's 130 and humid, and they'll tell you that, yeah, Iraq is, it is dry and it is nicer. Anyway.
It's true. It's very true.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
The dryness makes a huge difference.
So I'm walking from my aluminum can down to our combat operations center, and we're shooting, you know, Glimmers, which is our, you know, our artillery rocket in 2006. And I'm wondering, where the hell are we shooting? What are we shooting that at? Because it didn't shoot that often. And so I walk in the COC and I said, hey, I walked over to the fires guys. I said, what are they shooting at? And he said, sir, they're dropping the terrain station in Ramadi. Now, I was in Ramadi in 2004 when Al Anbar blew up. And we had fought there for going on 2 years. And 2 years later, we were dropping the train station and we were just rubbling the place. So it was more fighting took place in Ramadi than it did in Fallujah. But Fallujah is the bigger name between the two, for those that don't know. What was it like to go to rebuild that place, John?
You know, Mac, we really lucked out. The Anbar Awakening had already occurred and was pretty much over with. There was still elements, you know, Al-Qaeda guys and stuff, and they eventually killed Sheikh Sattar, and they were around. There was a battle called the Battle of Donkey Island where they surprised a bunch of guys that had been infiltrating in and had a big shootout with them. But just for the most part, we were just really living in the lap of luxury compared to what you guys had gone through. There was just a buttload of battle damage to the city, but they were very busy rebuilding it. And for the most part, we were received with open arms. And you know, when we asked them to, you know, consider, you know, standing up a provincial council or you know, finding a place to meet and making that routine and keeping notes and, you know, minutes and, you know, things that Robert's rules require of a governing council, they pretty much got on board. And it was really it was a pleasure. It was hard in the beginning because when we arrived, we didn't have PSDs to move us. And so, you know, we're, you know, 4 months of, you know, ass pain to get there and, you know, 9,000 miles or 6,000 miles, whatever it is to get there. And then the last 3 miles to get downtown, you know, we couldn't get off a Blue Diamond to do it without, you know, having to beg or bum or borrow a seat on some convoy. And we told General Allen this, and he gave us his PSD. He gave us his ground PSD. He said, you know, I travel by helicopter. And I really don't need it. So, you know, and again, that's the kind of guy General Allen is. You know, he just, you know, there's a problem. Let's fix it. You know, let's move on. Let's not agonize over it. And so we were able to get into town every day. We worked a lot with Governor Mamoun, who is kind of, you know, famous. And then Dr. Abdel Salam and Mr. Hamis, who ran the provincial council. And just slowly but surely, you know, with a huge amount of industry and energy, the Iraqis rebuilt Ramadi. And by the time we left, and you know, the Marines and the Army were there with their engineers to help as well. But a lot of the things like the huge pools of standing sewer water and the big piles of garbage and, you know, the filth had been cleaned up. And folks were rocking and rolling. Their little open-air shop, the bazaar was open. I knew we had won because they were selling Marine T-shirts there, and the kids were running around with Spider-Man T-shirts and Marine T-shirts and stuff. So,
you know, I went
but
to...
But then, as you know, the story, it all melted down again,
right.
Unfortunately.
That had to be awful to watch for you. I mean, it was awful to watch for us, but, you know, anybody involved in the rebuilding had to be, you know, there's so many parallels between Vietnam and Iraq. It's frightening. It's frightening. I went to dinner at Larry Nicholson's house. He was the regimental commander of the 5th Marines when I was working in Fallujah for him. And he's a good friend of mine. And so I'm at dinner at his house. And he says, "Hey, Mac, let me show you some pictures." And I said, "Okay." And he's showing me pictures of Marines, I want to say with no helmets and flak jackets on, in Ramadi, painting curbs. They were painting them yellow or something. And then there were pictures of a marathon or not a marathon, but a run that went on in Ramadi. And I looked at him and I said, I didn't want to look. I feel like the picture's going to explode or something like that. Because there's nothing good that's ever come out of that place. And he goes, "You wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe what's going on there." Well, John, congratulations on the work that you did there. I mean, it's a shame that, you know, that the Iraqi military can withstand and you know, for a lot of different reasons, ISIS when it entered. Talk to me about how do you get to Afghanistan? You come home and say, "I need." You come home and say, "I need more of that."
Go ahead. Sorry, I missed that. Say again.
I said you came home and then said, "I need more of that."
Yeah. No, I came back home and I think I kind of went through a little bit of what you've talked about often on your show. I wasn't in combat, but I had worked at a level and with a kind of a sense of satisfaction that I think is pretty rare in government service. And 18 months back in the Pentagon doing PowerPoint slides and, you know, just working on stuff that didn't really seem to matter. I went back to the Iraq Policy Office and was a deputy director for Iraq Policy. But you know, as my my boss told me when I walked to the door, he said, you know, that you're not making policy here. It's all been made already. You know, so you know, don't come in here with false expectations. That was kind of disappointing. And after 18 months, I said, gosh, you know, I really would like to go back overseas. And my wife's a Marine. She understood. So I volunteered for Afghanistan. And by that time, Afghanistan was in trouble. And the Obama administration had come in and they were doing this surge for Afghanistan. So, again, they needed civilians to fill the State Department billets. And again, I raised my hand and went. Didn't know where I was going to go, but I wanted to go down where the Marines were in the South. And I lucked out week of orientation there at the embassy in Kabul. And then they pushed us out and I got to go down and join Colonel Randy Newman at 7th Marines in Helmand, part of TUMEB. So that was great. I got to spend a year with them, about 9 months with them and about 3 months or a little less with you guys and Dave Furness and 1st Marines.
The all right, I want you're doing some great stuff, and I want to talk about that. But I'd like to talk about Afghanistan first. We've gone institutionally, we've gone from the position here on All Marine Radio from being pessimistically cautious to straight up pessimist about the future of Afghanistan. Again, I'm so. You know, again, parallels to Vietnam, us trying to create, in my opinion, something that had never existed in Afghan history and underestimating the time and the capital requirement it would take to create some form of federal government that had some credibility, a national military that had not only credibility but the combat power to do what we wanted it to do. You know, you say these things, but you can't fairy dust them. They have to be built, and it's going to take a long time, and it's hard to do it when you're in contact with the enemy. And so I'm curious. You've seen the DOD side, you've seen the Marine side, you've seen the State Department side. Give me your thoughts on the future of Afghanistan.
Well, I'm sorry to say I agree with you. I mean, I'm very pessimistic about what the outcome may be there. And I've been through all the, you know, the stages of grief as it relates to Afghanistan. But I think that the way things stand right now is that very much like when we left Iraq, they sense that we're either going to leave or we're going to downsize to the point where we'll be nearly irrelevant. And so folks that are in power want to consolidate power. And, you know, there's in a place like Afghanistan, you know, they have a constitution, but there's really nothing to stop them from doing that. And we all saw what happened the moment we stepped across the border into Kuwait, the last soldier out of Iraq. You know, they immediately issued the Iraqi government issued a death warrant for the Kurdish vice president. And, you know, I mean, there was real serious bloodletting that started happening.
Which is, and, John, which truth be told, that's the way they've always done it, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, it has been. You know, you can't say that universally because there's brilliant, brilliant, very sophisticated, very Western people in those countries, both Iraq and Afghanistan. And you know, the subject really here is Afghanistan. And, you know, Mac, an entire generation of people starting from age 5, 6, 7 have come all the way up. They're in their mid-20s now. They've seen the Western way. They've been around NATO, ISAF. They've been around, you know, the way that the West does business in Afghanistan. And a lot of these people have been educated overseas, many in Western countries, and have come back to Afghanistan. So there's this, I'll call them elite, but I don't mean that in a derogatory or, you know, predatory way. But they're definitely the educated class in Afghanistan that Afghanistan hasn't seen for about 40 years, you know, because as things began to melt down with the Russian involvement there, and then eventually the, you know, the collapse of the whole thing and the civil war, schooling and those kinds of things were an absolute luxury. And if you were schooled overseas, you stayed overseas. But you look at people now in the government of Afghanistan at the mid-level and in a lot of the businesses. I've got many, many friends who are over there, and they're slugging it out. You know, they're doing it the Western way. They get up every day and go to work, and they want the same things we do. And in fact, the rural villages feel very strongly that they want a better life as well, which is kind of a little bit of our story at Team Afghan Power. But yeah, it's awful to see the few key figures, Ghani and some of these people that really, really have their hands on the controls for the country, just whipsaw the political situation back and forth. And they're unwilling to step aside at times and say, you know, I'm going to give this up for the better, for the bigger good of the, you know, of the effort and so forth. So
what do you see as the biggest problem? You know, because, you know, how do you, you know, the United States has negotiated with the Taliban, you know, the federal government hadn't been involved in that. How do you, can you lay out for me a path that this turns out good, John? Because everything I see, you know, the Taliban call the shots, and you know, and the Afghan military. I mean, again, watching the South Vietnamese military after we left, you know, essentially be decimated without U.S. air power. You know, it's like, what is going to happen? You know, if and when we back away. You know, from the, and we say we won't do that, but we told the Vietnamese the same thing. What is going to happen? Can you lay out a path that this works out well for me? Because I don't see it. I don't see, and all those people that have been, you know, raised on Western thought and seen and participated in Western process and how this goes, because there's been no nation on the country like the United States. We don't come to conquer and exploit you. You know, we come to hopefully free you and then partner with you, which is unique in world history. And they've been a part of that. But what's coming back to them is a movement back in history, back to what the Taliban would call more traditional, you know, times, that they seek to honor women within the context of their culture, with everything that means. So can you lay out a path that this works out well, or do you believe that ultimately it will roll back in time and they will have choices, you know, to, you know, shut up and color, and you know how this works, because we don't really embrace Jeffersonian democracy. We don't embrace the unique concept of minority rights is truly unique. And John described it, you know, talking about when we, the last person out, you know, step foot in Kuwait, and then what happened? Minority rights around the world are not a thing. So your thoughts on all of that, John?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'm a smart enough guy to, you know, I think somebody like General Allen or someone would give you a much more sophisticated answer, Mac. But for me, the big failing that underlies a lot of this is the lack of understanding of the fact that there's never been central control of Afghanistan. So the constitution that they have right now, which we help them write, has a national government, much very similar to ours. I understand that the document was kind of plagiarized from when the king was in Afghanistan. So kind of a similar sort of a constitution. So you got this central authority, the central power in Kabul, and then that radiates, you know, the governance from there out to the local, you know, levels. And that's never worked in Afghanistan. The heart and soul of Afghanistan is in the rural villages. They have their own form of governance, as you know, because you served there. And it's very effective. You know, it's the government by Shura.
Right.
You know, they have a Shura leader, and they have a concerned group of elders, usually elder males, and they take up issues, you know, and are representative of the various families and tribes that make up that village. And, you know, they communicate, you know, to other villages and up and everything, but their principal focus is inward on the care and feeding of the village. And the national government, the national governments that have existed in Afghanistan have never been really able to meaningfully contribute to that. in a way that would woo them away from local governance and allow them to kind of have as their vision that, yeah, we're part of this larger thing called the Afghan national government, you know, which is how it works over here, because we get federal money as states, you know, and the counties get federal money. And, you know, there's a trickle down effect, you know, tax dollars collected and then, you know, it trickles down and there's programs. And, you know, all the 50 states here are kind of, I've once heard them described as 50 reinvention labs, you know, to 50 different reinvention labs where new ideas are being tried and things like that. It folks, for the most part, in the rural villages are living through subsistence farming. And that doesn't leave a lot of bandwidth for creative thinking. So if you have the majority population that is rural, remote, living at a fairly subsistence level, and they're not really seeing or getting anything, you know, from the national government. And oftentimes the national government is predatory. Again, you know, you were over there, you know, the police that the national government sends down and they end up, you know, fleecing the locals and stuff. And then there's corruption, both, you know, just sort of passive corruption where fees are charged for things that aren't really necessary and stuff, all the way to real active corruption where politicians are involved in drug smuggling or, you know, extortion and kidnapping and stuff. And it just it's a kind of a broken model the way it's set up right now. And, you know, we just sort of frankly, and I'm not as well informed as I should be. Probably some of your listeners will take issue with this, but it seems to me like we've just doggedly stuck to that model and not been willing to work with the Afghans to say, you know, this isn't working that well. Let's modify it and learn, you know, get some lessons learned here applied. So under all, that's the weak base, in my opinion. And then from there flows a lot of the other, you know, issues that you address, you know, the armed forces, it's really not ready. You know, they don't have the enablers that they need to fight a military that's being trained, armed and equipped in Pakistan. And I mean, it's a young democracy, you know, they're struggling for their identity. They've got all of the problems of these various ethnic cultures that have been kind of formed together when the country formed, and they all mistrust each other. I mean, honestly, you talk to guys up in the Panjshir Valley where I work, and you know they're very suspicious of the Hazars or the other groups. And you know, then you talk to the Hazars and, oh yeah, the Panjshiris, you know, you want to keep an eye out for them, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And I mean we have a little bit of that here in the U.S. but by and large I think they tend to identify with where they get their power from. And, you know, we'll tell you we're Americans because that's where we get our power. They'll tell you that they're Muslim or they're from a certain area or a certain tribe, a certain ethnicity, because that's where they get their power from. And I think it's really hard to bring a country together when you have those kind of big, big fault lines.
And when you say get your power from, what exactly do you mean?
Well, you know, we're for the most part as Americans, we're pretty mindful, I guess, particularly, you know, probably since the war began about being Americans, you know, and what that means. And maybe we always have, and maybe after World War II is where it really started to grow. But, you know, there's no question. I mean, we created the world banking system after World War II. We, you know, you just tick down the list of things that the United States led the rest of the world, the rebuilding of Europe, the rebuilding of Japan, and, you know, the setting up of market economies and those kinds of things, and the creating the environments where those could happen. So we're generally pretty aware that we still occupy a pretty lead role in the world. And you know, I think there's a great deal of pride in that for the most part. So folks tend to say, yeah, I'm an American. You know, if you're overseas, somebody says, you know, where are you from? I say, I'm from the United States. You know, you could say I'm from Kentucky, but, you know, you're from America, you know. But you rarely hear folks in the rural villages run around saying, yeah, I'm Afghan, you know. It's much more, well, I'm Panjshiri, you know, or I'm from Herat or, you know, wherever, Nimruz or wherever. So they tend to relate to that, or they relate to their ethnicities. You know, I'm I'm Hazar, I'm Tajik, I'm Uzbek, I'm, you know, whatever. So I just think it's a different mindset, and it for them, it plays against the whatever you want to call that knitting together of the fabric of a society that makes a country strong.
Okay. See if you can give me a short answer to this, and then I want to talk about the initiative that you have going, John, which is called Team Afghan Power. Yep. I talk about the OPT, in which somebody, a group of people, sat and said, talked about broadening the war in Afghanistan, the ground war in particular, and transforming Afghanistan into something that it has historically never been. Were we just so intoxicated with, and I'll use this phrase, but I don't really mean it, American exceptionalism, that we were blind to the realities, even the lessons of Vietnam, in terms of what it takes to change a culture and to change a nation? I mean, the task that those who initiated that policy levied on those who tried to implement it was impossible, except in the longest term. You know, I mean, we were in Germany and Japan 60 years, you know, and did we think we could do that in 5 years and just leave? I mean, you've been on the ground both in a number of different capacities in both those countries. What we tried to do in Afghanistan, now when you look at it, it was absurd. We should have gone there to get Osama bin Laden, to kill the Taliban that were responsible for what happened on September 11th. But beyond that, I mean, the task is daunting. I mean, can you make sense of that?
Oh, it sure is. You know, Mac, I can't, because we're very good often at figuring out stuff like that. The thing is that for something like Afghanistan, I'll just stay on Afghanistan for a second.
Sure.
You got to figure it out before you commit, because I don't think you can ever catch up once you're already, you know, woven into whatever the policies and the strategies are. The Pentagon is too big. It's too sluggish. National leadership pride is too big. You know, you got a first term president. He wants to get reelected. He's not about to have anybody running around saying it isn't working. And then you get into the second term, and then they realize it isn't working. And, you know, but they still don't want to embarrass the president. And the new guy comes in and he says, well, the generals are telling me, you know, I got to pour it on for us to win. And but way, way, way back, you know, in October of 2001, now, of course, you read in hindsight, it's perfectly clear. Guys like Thomas Barfield and people like that were saying, hey, guys, you know, you better think this through very carefully and stay away from saying things like we're not going to do nation building, because that whole effort is going to be, you know, at least one generation, maybe two or three, of nothing but nation building before you can get the genetics changed around, you know, the genetic memory right of how to do it right. So we just really, and you read those Afghanistan papers or Pentagon papers, whatever they're called, the Washington Post stories of the lessons learned. It's just heartbreaking. Most of the senior people admitted privately they had no freaking idea, you know, how to do it or what it was like. And, you know, Mac, when we got over there, we were first timers and we first got on the ground. You remember looking at that and going, you know, holy shit, are you kidding me? We need like 50 times the number of people over here to get this done. You know, I mean, I remember having that feeling many times, you know.
Well, and then I'll tell you something, John, that I was an economics major in college. And you know, it was very stunning to me to find out that we really didn't send the Marines down to Latin America for peace and democracy, that we had economic interest down there in the Continental Fruit Company and the United and the United Can Company that manufactured fruit and had factories and whatnot. We had huge interest. We had huge economic interest there, and that's why we went there. And so, to me, this whole culture in Helmand is based on a poppy. Now, can you find me something else? Economics question. Can you find me something else that these farmers can grow that can sustain the culture? And that means the culture is the bribes they have to pay, right, to the different people. And it's just the cost of doing business there, right? You got to pay, you know, off the police chief so he won't eradicate, you know. So when they go do local eradication, yeah, right, he just drives his tractors through your field once and leaves, and they don't whack the bulbs, which is take a stick and have policemen going through and really destroying your crop. But in order to have that, you got to have the money to pay for it. Okay, so if you don't have another crop to do all that, then mm-hmm. and then I heard General Allen say this. Well, the pomegranate can do that. Okay, are we going to pay them substitute wages for how long? A decade, in order for them to mm-hmm. grow their trees and to get a mature crop? Because if you don't do that, you're going to have too many of them that don't. I mean, how do you solve this economically? Yeah. And there was never any good answer to it. And
yeah,
so,
and as you know, as an economist, Mac, I mean, you got to have a market for that stuff too.
Right.
And the market is made up of discrete bits and pieces, you know, supply chain and, you know, logistics, you know, capacity to move stuff and refrigerated storage and on and on and on. And poppy, just, you don't have that problem. Once it's wet opium in a plastic bag, shit, it could sit there for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years under some guy's, you know, rack in his mud hut, and he can use it as barter and trade and stuff. But we tried substitute farming down in Helmand when I was with the 7th Marines, and there was the only thing that we could even come close to poppy value wise would have been saffron. And again, we just didn't have the supply chain, you know, to get it out of country and get it into Walmart or, you know, someplace where it would really, really have a volume, you know, sale.
And truth be told, you couldn't do saffron until you solved the Taliban issue, because I can't remember what part of the year it was. Maybe it was the spring of 11. All of a sudden, we're medevacing all these little kids for injuries. Right, little girl got shot, double tapped in the chest, got shot through the forearms because she had covered her face because she didn't want to see, the guy shoot her, and we're trying to medevac her, and you know, there's kids being burned, and it was an accident that they spilled oil. Oh, it was a pro. Well, what was going on was an intimidation campaign using kids, and that it was, first of all, the girls aren't as valuable as the boys. So you start with the girls when you're going to intimidate a farmer who says he's not going to grow poppy, and or you burn people. And so the pressure that these guys were under, and you can't do anything till you control the countryside. And again, I'm watching the Vietnam series, and you know, you're seeing this fight over the rice farmer's heart and mind, you know, when we go out there and we have speakers and talk about democracy and whatnot. And then the Viet Cong come at night and they live there and they're, mm-hmm. They know everybody and they say, hey, they're liars. Yeah. And so it's like, how mm-hmm. could you even, so I don't know. It just, and the thing I guess that frustrates me the most is that the first guys that were in there, Franks and Myers, they were Vietnam guys. And like, did you forget
something?
Yeah, it is. Did you forget every fucking lesson? And John, you know, you lived in the shadow of Vietnam your entire time in the Marine Corps. So did I. For those guys mm-hmm. to forget the lessons of Vietnam and go reenact it, to me is horrible.
I think it was Ricks who wrote the book The Generals.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen that or not. It came out about 5 years ago, I guess, and worth a read. And it you know. Short biographies by chapter for various generals. But one of the points he makes is he theorizes that the Gulf War was one of the worst lessons that we could learn. We came back from that, you know, with the victory parade and having crushed the Iraqi army and everything. And when 9/11 came along, we said, yeah, we can do this. You know, we just did it, you know, in Iraq. And we went after it with this conventional military mindset. And, you know, the generals were, you know, once and in fact, kind of forced by Rumsfeld to go light But it was nevertheless, even light, it was still a conventional style military, one that you would want to pit against a peer, you know, a uniform military against uniform military. And these guys, as you know, Mac and McCall, you know very, very well, they just don't fight that way. They do what you were talking about. They burn children. They hide, you know, in populated places, and they look like, and they're the locals. They're all, you know, mixed together. It's very hard to shake that out. So, you know, they came up with a term while we were, or I guess it was just before we got into Hellman, clear, hold, and build. And that was, you know, the clear and hold part was the military, and the build was going to be, you know, the NGOs and state and aid and everybody. And that was where we fell on our ass. You know, the Marines did exactly what they were told to do, and a great job of it. They cleared places. They fought, took the casualties, the whole nine yards. And then, you know, there was just crickets afterwards. I mean, these pissant little programs that were tried, and they never had the, you know, you need a huge amount of volume, you know, to get something to really kickstart. And we didn't have to stay in power and stuff. So yeah, it's disappointing. I will say that.
All right. I want to talk about your Team Afghan Power. So obviously you're scarred by your experience. The things that you see there never leave. I mean, I'll tell a quick story. John made me think of it here, talking about the little girl getting shot twice in the chest and murdered essentially to intimidate her father. I was driving down the 405 here in Southern California, I don't know, a couple of years ago, and my daughter, who was 14 at the time, said to me, could I ask you a question? And I said, sure, which means it's going to be a serious question. And she said, did you ever feel bad because of the people you killed in Iraq and Afghanistan? And I said, no. I said, and I thought, like, how do I explain this to my 14-year-old daughter? I said, Colleen, it's more fun than going to the water park. And she put her hands over her mouth and she said, Dad! And I said, Colleen, they kill little kids. I told her that story. I told her that story. I said, they burn little kids because their dads won't grow opium, which is how they tax opium, and that's how they fund what they do. I said, they're bad people. Do I feel bad about it? Never. Ever, ever, ever have I or will I ever feel bad about that. And, again, it's just so frustrating, you know, to think back on it. And that's the future. Those people are going to go back to, you know, and let me tell you, and this is no different from the South Vietnamese civilian population. They had to learn to live in both orbits. They had no choice. As the Afghan farmers in Helmand, they've had to learn how to live in the Russian orbit, how to live in the American orbit. And I remember vividly when Barack Obama, President Obama, when he said we're going to be out of there by 2014, our electronic warfare guys listen, right? And you start seeing reports that, you know, the local, you know, tribal elders are communicating with the shadow government people that are Taliban shadow governor and things like that, that you have in every province in Afghanistan and other leaders in Pakistan, in Quetta, saying, hey, look, you know, we're cooperating with the Americans because we have no choice. And we're looking forward to when you come back and resuming our, you know, our relationship with you guys, you know, inshallah, blah, 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 blah. And you're reading it going, holy shit, man. Everything that we fought for is going to go away if we're not here in numbers to implement it and oversee it. And I won't say it's happened, but we're all not very excited about the future. So anyway, So let's transition, John. You've obviously been scarred by that experience. You've gone back and done work in Afghanistan. Tell everybody what you're doing with Team Afghan Power.
Yeah. And I just, you know, I wouldn't say that I was scarred, Mac, but I would say that it definitely has left me with a deep set of thoughts and opinions that I probably wouldn't have had if I hadn't gone there. I can think of guys that were shot or stepped on IDs or had their friends blown up and, you know, died in their arms and stuff. Those guys, I would say, rightly could claim they're scarred. But, you know, I came back from working with you guys in Helmand in October, of 2010 and taught for my last 2 years in government at the National War College or the National Defense University. And I taught national security studies and the Afghan-Pakistan regional studies with another guy for the AFPAC HANDS program. And during that period, I met an economist. You'll be pleased with this because your education is economics. And he said, you know, we're focusing on the wrong thing. It is literally about the economy, stupid. You know, the old famous line from the Clinton election period. And he said, successful models are out there where this has been done, but it was done not by the M in dime, you know, the famous acronym DIME, the four elements of national power, M being military power. It wasn't done by them. It was done by the E part of dime, which is the economic order, the element of national power. And he went on to say that, you know, what is America? America is a great big frickin' business, you know. And yeah, we're shut right now because of the virus. But I mean, prior to the virus hitting, we're firing on all 10 cylinders, just rocking and rolling. And we create market economies all over the world because of the size and power of our market economy. And we don't do it as grant aid programs, and we don't do it at the end of a bayonet. We do it because we generate a pull for products, goods, services, and people. And that's the way out of Afghanistan. And so myself and some Marines got together and said, you know, let's open a dialogue on LinkedIn about this. And we did for about a year. We called it Phase Zero, the shaping phase. And from that came the idea to create a nonprofit that would experiment by going back to Afghanistan into rural villages and talking and working with them on how we could take their existing natural resources beyond just the farming piece of it and retool that, retool them to harness it so that they could grow economically and in so doing connect, you know, to the rest of the world, which is another problem rural villages in Afghanistan have. And so we decided renewable energy would probably be the best way to do that, since most of those villages have no electricity. And that's a great a disabler, as you know. If you're fed and safe and your family's safe, really in this world, the next step up is electricity to connect you to the world, get the internet in, get telemedicine in, get, you know, refrigerated storage for crops, water, you know, water pumps, all kinds of things that electricity bring you. And so in 15, we started Team Afghan Power, December 2015, and it's a nonprofit. We've got a website, www.teamafghanpower.org, and it's veteran and development practitioners. And most of them are people that we served with either in Iraq or Afghanistan. We have 42 veterans, mostly Marines, who support us. We've had about 115 people donate to us, and about three quarters of those are Marines. And it's, you know, it's everything from $25 to $5,000. We had a $10,000 donation not that long ago.
Wow. Congratulations.
And we're creating a capacity in a small village in the Panjshir Valley where it's very safe to have the people of a small village there design, own, operate, and maintain a renewable energy microgrid, which is powered by solar, and that'll power their school. So we're well into that, deep into that. We've got the design. We've been to the village four times. We've got the governance piece of it set up. And now when they get the COVID virus behind us, we're ready to do the build. And then we'll do what any good small unit does. Mac, we'll fall back from that and take our lessons learned and try to retool and do the next one smarter next time. But, yeah, the two things for your listeners are, one, go to our site and donate, and two, be available to go back with us if you're willing, because it's very cathartic. It's doing it right. You know, it's doing what a lot of us wish we could have done when we got our hands on stabilization programs and CERT money and stuff.
No, you know what? Again, I watch Vietnam veterans at the end of that who have gone back to Vietnam, and whether it be open doors to educate Vietnamese here in the United States, go back and do projects.
But this all eerily follows the same path. But so,
John, do you believe, how do you do this given the security environment?
Well, we're poor because we're a small charity, a small 501c3, so we can't afford a big security footprint, you know, with armored cars and all that. So we just use passive measures. We go in small groups. We wear local clothing. We're in beat up old shitty Toyotas, and we have a hell of a lot of Afghans that are supporting us, and they pick us up at the airport and they move us up into the valley, which is very safe. Once you're in Panjshir, you're pretty much out of the opportunity for violence. They're very monolithic, you know, it's the Tajik Uzbek thing, and they're not about to let anything happen to you. They're very Western in their thinking, so they're real pro-American, and that helps. And once we're up there, if we need something, we can order it, and it can be brought up from Kabul, and that's how we'll build the grid. Most of the vendors are in Kabul. We can get the panels and all that there. And we have some engineers that are Afghans that live there, and they'll do the build for us. So it just keep a low profile, Mac, you know?
No. Talk about what electricity means to a community like that. I mean, most of, you know, the more wealthy people will have generators, right, that provide mm-hmm. themselves with electricity. But by and large, you know, they're still living as Afghans have lived for centuries, relative to light and electricity and whatnot. But electricity changes, right, your entire world outlook, because you can now be connected to the planet because of electricity, no matter where you are in the world. What's the impact of your program, John?
Well, your last phrase is exactly right, Mac. I mean, you know, you take a bunch of school kids, and you've seen the pictures, you know, they're sitting on a dirt floor in a, you know, a mud brick building with, you know, some guy, you know, in a chalkboard, you know, pointing at, you know, a circle and saying, that's the earth, you know, that kind of thing. You sit that child who's, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, very formative year period, and in front of a computer, and show them, you know, a satellite photograph of the earth, or, you know, what a cow, you know, a healthy cow looks like versus a sick one. If you're, you know, teaching ag programs, or, you know, animal husbandry programs, or whatever. And it's incredibly illuminating for them. Telemedicine, most of the clinics there are run by women, and that way women can go there to be treated.
Right.
The peculiar shortcoming is all their records are manual, so they write things down on paper, right, and then they give them to somebody who gets in a car, drives to Kabul, and gives it to the Ministry of Health, who then, you know, tries to key punch it in, and that way they get a little money the following year for their budget for that thing. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, the paper gets lost, or the records are destroyed, or they never take the time to write it down. So, you know, it's a small example, but it's an important one. But computers, the internet, and electricity in general just gives you all of those things. We're blessed. We've had people contribute satellite internet equipment a subscription.
So now, I mean, if you could imagine, I mean, just think about this. Think about going to school, right, and learning out of books the way, you know, people have done for centuries on this planet, right? And then all of a sudden, there's electricity in the room, and there's lights, and there's a TV, right? And the TV can show you these things that you've never seen before in your life. It can show you this world out there that's out there. And then, as you said, and one of the things that, you know, I've done it with the VA twice in the last month, which is telemedicine. And let me tell you, I prefer it. Unless it's something that you really need to go get seen for, to be able to stay at home, talk to a doctor, if they need, you know, if it's something they need to take a look at on your body, you could take a picture, send it to them. They can look at it and say, hey, you really do need to come in, or, okay, I've got everything I need. I mean, and that's in our culture. The lessons for them, I talk about a powerful, one of the things we did in 2006 that was one of the most powerful things I saw Marines react to, because I was coordinating for it, was all the female doctors in Iraq, or many of them, and from Kuwait, and with female nurses, flew into Fallujah, and then we moved them up to a city called Karma, and they treated women with the support of the, you know, the tribal elder there and the sheikh, and we were scared shitless that somebody would bomb it. But the Marines who guarded it that day were so moved because he said, I remember these Marines saying, sir, all we did was watch people cry. And when I say cry, I don't mean like shed tears. I mean, they were sobbing. Their children had lived with these things. Some of these women had never seen a doctor in their life. And they were being treated, and they were doing some follow-up stuff and arranging for stuff that was going to change the lives of these women, these women and these little girls. And they said, you know, sir, I don't want to get weird or anything like that, but it was one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And so these things that you're enabling, John, are, I mean, to say the least, are life-altering. But I mean, you're going to change the way a whole group of people live.
And you know, Mac, we've got a theory, and I don't know if it's going to, you know, play out correctly or not. But you got to start from somewhere. And the theory is that if you create a more educated workforce, you've created the schools become force providers for the community. And rather than run off to, you know, Dubai to be a waiter or a dishwasher or something, or run to Kabul to get some menial job because there's money there, they can stay in their villages, and those villages will grow economically. Because, you know, you've listed a few of them. I mean, there's probably 50 things that electricity brings that have a direct impact on economic growth. That otherwise, if they don't have it, they just don't have it. You know, they're just doing subsistence farming. And that's the theory we have is that it will inoculate these villages against providing their youth to the insurgency. So in a way, it's a countering violent insurgency program. Now, I admit to, you know, you and your listeners that we're at the very beginning of it, and it's a almost a generation long project to get it to have real fruit in a place like Afghanistan to bear fruit. But yeah, again, you got to start somewhere. And, you know, we just think that this is the right way to do it. One village at a time, step at a time, gradually. And then you scale it up when you've got your dope down, you know.
Let me read you. I've got an email for you. I got a message. Here's a text message. Let's see. Hold on. Jesus, he's not describing Afghanistan. He's describing Vietnam in the 1960s. That's from a Vietnam guy. here's an email with a question. Ask John about his thoughts on the teamwork of the Hellman PRT. And then this. The hybrid solution for Afghanistan is to leave enough blacks off to continue taking terrorist threats off the battlefield, enough whites off to advise the Afghan special forces in Kabul, and two larger conventional QRFs, Bagram and Kandahar, to be able to respond to larger Taliban attacks across the country. Remove all the, in parentheses, side-by-side advisors outside of Kabul, except small advisor teams that would fly back to locations to be able to connect Afghan ministerial processes and the Afghan security forces. Estimated force of 2,000 contractors will be indefinitely rotating into Afghanistan for at least 5 years to prevent collapse. You want to talk about the teamwork of the Hellman PRT?
Yeah, I mean, there were different personalities that came in and went through there. And I think that they had an identity crisis because before we arrived, it was British, and the British forces had that battle space, you know, RC South. And I think that when the 20,000, I guess it was Marines eventually that were there, and then we, you know, embedded a lot of Marines and a lot of State Department or civilian types at the PRT. And I just think it was not a it wasn't done very it wasn't done with a lot of synchronizing. It was kind of a, you know, the Americans are here. You know, I mean, there was Brits that expressed to me the view that we fought and died here. Now you guys are coming in, you know, and it's like, well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, just go back to World War II. I mean, you know, we had, you know, our armies were, you know, three and four times the size of, you know, the British armies, which is a bigger country. We have a bigger, you know, base, economic and personnel base to do that with. But I just think it was kind of awkward. And when we broke and became RC Southwest, I would have liked to have seen, and I pushed hard to create an American PRT that serviced that sector. But I think Kandahar and then Eikenberry up in Kabul, the ambassador, they either didn't hear of that idea or they didn't want to do that. So both those RCs, RC South and RC Southwest, stayed kind of under the quote, you know, non-kinetic leadership of the British PRT there in Lashkargah. And it was under-resourced. I also think the PRT leader that was there when we first got there was not terribly effective. And she left and a guy came in, as I understand it. I was leaving then, but you guys would know. A guy came in who had actually taken the time to go over to spend some time with the Marines in Camp Pendleton before he came down to take over the PRT. And he was very effective, I understand. But the PRT that I was on in Iraq was very different than the one in Helmand. The one in Iraq was a U.S. State Department owned, operated, and led PRT that was supported logistically by the Marines. The one in Afghanistan was really, really a fruitcake. I mean, it was, you know, the Brits and the Danes and the U.S. and civilians and contractors and military. And, you know, I just didn't think it couldn't figure itself out. And the other problem they had was, Mac, to be blunt, was, you know, they were up in a place that would look like, you know, the frickin' Land of Oz with all the flower gardens and, you know, Lashkargah, Las Vegas night on Thursday nights and all that nonsense. And, you know, 20 clicks away, Marines are getting turned inside out by IEDs. And, you know, you just felt like it was like the boardwalk in Kandahar. You know, you went to the boardwalk in Kandahar. You're like, what in the hell are we doing? Are we at war? Really? It was very not out of sync with what the reality was.
Not here. We're not. That's for sure. I remember going home on leave and going through there and thinking, this is crazy. This is like, I don't live in this world. And this is, they think this is war. And, you know, they were having a football game in that big quad. And then the Canadians or somebody was getting ready to play inline hockey at the inline hockey rink there. And just thinking, wow, this is so far from what I do. The, here's another email. Mac, first of all, a Bravo Zulu to John for what he's doing in Afghanistan. I often had the thought when I was in Iraq, as I was reading about the number one import was satellite dishes now. It had been alcohol and pornography, and now that Saddam was gone, it was satellite dishes. And I believed what John was articulating a bit ago, and that is, once people begin to have multiple sources of information, they'll figure it out. And you cannot keep lightning in a bottle. So at some point, there will be friction. And that is the way that the planet has operated for all these centuries. And I do believe electricity combined with the free flow of information creates a power that you are going to see flex itself at some point in Iran, at some point in the Middle East. All those monarchies will go the way that all monarchies have gone. And the same thing will happen in China, and the same thing ultimately will happen in Russia again. So hats off to him for having the courage and the resourcefulness to actually get this done. It is seed planting, though, and probably won't germinate for years, but it starts with opening the window, and electricity does that. Well done, Marine. Well done.
What a great, thank you very much, whoever wrote that. God bless you. That's encouraging.
Nice going. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you, John, that you want people to know?
Again, Mac, not to use your wonderful radio show as a fundraising venue, but
go ahead.
We're a nonprofit, and open your wallets, Marines. $10 will make a difference. None of us are paid. Nobody takes a paycheck, so we're all, you know, doing this on blue passports and, you know, whatever money we can raise. And we'd love to not only get donations, but we'd also like to get more Marines involved. The last trip out, I had a Marine with me. The previous trip before that, I had a Marine with me. It's so helpful to be in a tactical environment like that again, and to have guys with you that you just can completely rely on and trust. I mean, they're all over it, and it's just, you know, it's a wonderful thing. So to me, there are a number of organizations, Mac, that are doing what I'm doing. There's Rumi Spice. Guy's a former, I think he's a former Army Ranger who's doing that spice I just talked about a minute ago, saffron. Saffron imports from Afghanistan. There's Combat Flip Flops. There's Noru, guy that does the Marine that does Noru, and I call it the rise of the unarmed forces. You know, the government does a few things really well. You know, our government does a few things really well, as outlined in the Constitution. But this just isn't one of them. This is private sector space, you know, building markets. That's what we do in America. And even though we're a nonprofit now, we hope to morph into an LLC and go to scale on this thing. And, you know, it's jobs, it's money, it's the provision of a very, very needed resource, much like water and food. It's, you know, the next version of that, which is electricity. So, We'd love to have the assistance of anybody out there that's listening. And again, just, you know, go to our website and either, you know, contact me through that or make a donation. Great big fat donation button right on the front of our website there. But even $10, trust me, goes a long way. Right. And again, three quarters of our donors have been Marines. It's really edifying.
Give that website out one more time, John.
Sure. It's www.teamafghanpower.com. No spaces, no caps, no dots, just teamafghanpower.org, O-R-G.
All right. The first of all, John, I awesome conversation today. I enjoyed it. One more email. Hey, Mac, does John have any insight? Where's Kim Jong-un? Yeah, John, you worked with the State Department. Where is he?
No, I hate to disappoint your listener. I don't have a clue. Wherever he is, I'm sure our president can get a hold of him.
I'll ask you one final comment. It's interesting watching this transformation in the Marine Corps and the nation's pivot to the Pacific. And when you watch when you look at the literature of fighting inside the weapons engagement zone and all this other stuff, to me, I don't know how you're going to do that if you're not deeply economically and diplomatically already in Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, and Indonesia. If you are, there will be no war because, you know, the American military already embedded there, already works there, already partners there, mm-hmm. right? Already hosted there. If you're not economically engaged, right? If you're not diplomatically engaged, then you're trying to fight outside of that going in. Good luck on that deal, right? You're better off just bottling it up and not even playing that game. So the visit of the Roosevelt to me is a little bit. To Vietnam, it's only the second time an American carrier had been to Vietnam since the war. In the last 25 years since we began diplomatic relations, it was a big, 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 big deal. And so to me, but it's emblematic of us and how vital it is to our national security to create, you know, those diplomatic and the E and dime economic ties. And if the president doesn't like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, then create incredible bilateral opportunities for these countries, right, to access the American market and whatnot. I'm curious at your thoughts on all that, John, and you, in terms of our national security. And to me, that's an incredible opportunity that, that the United States has on the backside of this COVID-19 thing, which has seen, right, totalitarianism for exactly what it is, opportunistic, exploitive. And over the weekend, the EU was going to come out with a report that I don't know if it condemned China, but it relatively strongly worded language. The Chinese got a hold of it and warned them, hey, be careful because this will end someday and you want to sell into China. And they watered down the language. And so I'm curious, yeah. There possibly, and whatever happens with, you know, with Kim Jong-un, the American, the United States and the free world and the part of the world that, that believes in a rules-based order might have two incredible opportunities here, right, to change the face of the future. Your thoughts on that?
I could not agree with you more, Mac. I mean, I can't really speak with great accuracy about what the opportunities are on the back end of the pandemic, but what you said makes sense. I mean, when this is over, it seems to me there'll be something of a vacuum there, and we should already have a plan to fill a as far as, you know, the economic development and our trans-Pacific trade with these countries, we need to just flood the zone. And, you know, you can say, well, we're already doing that because we have, you know, half the stuff we have is made in you know, the South Pacific in Asia somewhere, mostly in China, but, you know, a lot in Japan, a lot in Korea. You know, RC controlled model airplanes are all made in Vietnam now, and they're beautiful. You know, they're really high quality pieces of gear. And Malaysian, Indonesian, and all the different countries, Thailand, Taiwan. But I say double down, you know, let's make money and create an environment where peace is the only real option that anybody can choose, including China and collaboration, as opposed to leaving seams and cracks and vacuums where they can fill those. And you know, people talk about the islands that they've created on the reefs and stuff.
Right.
You know, I'm sure there's, you know, strategic significance to those, but they matter not if all of the economies in that area are all oriented towards us. So I completely agree with you. We need to really double down and have a massive effort of bilateral trade agreements with those organizations. And God knows they'd love it. I mean, they'd be all over it. I don't think there'd be any resistance. You know, China and Vietnam fought a war in 1980. I thought it was kind of interesting. People seem to forget that, and Vietnam kicked their ass. There's some angst about China's growth. And the whole nine-line, you know, diagram that they have, the old map that shows that they own the whole China Sea.
Yeah, what a joke. 1,300 miles.
Yeah, it scares the hell out of people.
1,300 miles.
They funded that thing up to the UN and for to be settled, and the UN looked at it and said, you got to be kidding me. This is just nonsense. So
the anyway, John, first of all, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you don't mind if I call you in the future and bring you back to talk to about whether it be Afghanistan or about whether it be to about your project. But thoroughly enjoyed the visit today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Max, so much. Really enjoyed it.
All right. Now, is it Gerlaw or Gerlaw?
Yeah, it's like Gerlaw, Gerlaw. Yeah, German.
German. All right. Gerlaw. All right. Thanks, John. Have a great day.
Thanks, Mac. You too. Semper Fi.
Semper Fidelis. That is John Gerlaw. Yeah. How about that? No, it's just an awesome, awesome guy. Interesting conversation. And again, what I love about, you know, guys like John and talking to them is they see it from a variety of, you know, spots on the through the kaleidoscope, if that makes sense. Hopefully it does. But no, I mean, and again, I'm still looking for an answer. Like, who thought that was a good idea? Somebody maybe I need to get Tom Ricks on. Maybe he can explain it to me after his analysis in his book. How does this make sense to anybody, let alone anybody who had ever fought in Vietnam? But John doing the right thing. Going back and turning on the power. Yeah, in Iraq, it was funny. You saw those reports that, you know, the smuggling routes that have been active for centuries, okay, for centuries, were smuggling satellite dishes. And booze and pornography were no longer number one. They were still in there, mind you, but as soon as they got the satellite dish, there went the need for pornography. They had it on their dish. All right. Tomorrow, Grant Newsham going to join us. Yep. So, and we'll talk to him about things like that. But my thanks to John for coming on today. And I know it bothers people. Well, I should say bothers people, but you know, what will be of Afghanistan? To me, it's my opinion. Don Rumsfeld sold that stuff where we can zoom around with special forces and we can kill them, and that's somehow going to make them quit. And it's never worked. It hasn't worked. And until we acknowledge that that's a failed concept, because, you know, it's the we killed XYZ leader in XYZ country, XYZ Taliban, ISIS, Al-Qaeda leader. It doesn't stop them, right? It's the equivalent of the body count in Vietnam. It's an irrelevant statistic because we have to do more of that to destroy them than to whack their leaders. They'll regenerate it. They'll go on. So, again, I wish I had a different I wish I had a different opinion on Afghanistan. I see that as a loser. So it hasn't worked yet. It's essentially what we tried in Iraq. Didn't work then. And I mean, I wish I had a different opinion. I just don't believe in it. Anyway, I mean, to me, what you can sell the American people for the United States is this. We will make sure that ISIS and Al-Qaeda are not allowed to stage in Afghanistan and to train there. What happens internally in Afghanistan will be something that the Afghans determine, and as it should be. And I think that what you'll see is a lot of what Tim and Jeff have talked about, which the Taliban largely controls the countryside. They negotiate some kind of coexistent agreement, and you'll see, you know, warlords that have ruled the cities continue to rule the cities because the Afghan doesn't have the ass to go in and tip them over. So, anyway, wish it were some other way, but that's what I believe. Long show today, but interesting. Anyway, thanks for listening. This program continues. Hour one, talking about a little bit of a DOD controversy in the secretary, the chairman is requesting a full investigation, which will take months, and essentially derail, without saying so, the reappointment of Brett Crozier as the commanding officer of the USS Theodore Roosevelt. But that's what General Milley, the chairman, has asked for. The Secretary of Defense says he will make up his mind this week, but that's a pretty interesting little thing. I've never heard of something like this in such a high-profile case where somebody would be reinstated. Never heard such a thing. and the implications that will be taken away by commanders in all services are that you have a chance if you decide to go public with your grievance. Is that in? And again, the Navy to me, it's such a struggling organization. Is that in the best interest? And if you're doing this because of the power of those sailors chanting as he left the ship, then I'm not sure what I say to that. That you're afraid of the public backlash? Yeah, maybe Brett Crozier has to go find another job for the greater good. So that's interesting. We'll talk about a little bit about Kim Jong-un. We'll talk about the data and an article that I talked about on Friday, but I wanted to read five facts from this article about what the data that is shown, the data from New York City, the data from a Stanford University study, the data from a USC study, and another study in the Los Angeles area. All have said the same thing. Much more of us have had the COVID-19 virus than was suspected. If that's the case, the mortality rate is extremely low. It is extremely concentrated in a segment of our culture. You'll hear about that. And the rest of our culture, 99.2%, are not impacted by it. So, and that has implications for public policy. So, anyway, have a great Monday. Get out there and get physically active. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life. Because the tenets of post-traumatic winning apply to a lot of people. Don't fake it if you're not doing good. Don't be afraid to talk about it. Don't hide in a bottle, a pill container, or a roach clip. Okay? Stay connected to your tribe. Stay physically fit. All right? And if you do those things, right, you'll get through it. You'll do all right. You'll solve the financial part of this. On that note, on a Monday, Almarine Radio, over and out.